Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew, and I'd like to welcome back to the show, Planet X researcher, John DiNardo. John, how you doing tonight?
Fine, thank you, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on. There's a lot going on. We've got a lot to talk about, and I thought tonight was a perfect night to get into a little bit of Planet X information. But first, I'd like to start with your background. It's been a while since you've been on here, so kind of reintroduce yourself. Tell us how you got started with this research and a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, I started up years ago as a Marine Corps aircraft electronics technician. When I was discharged from the Marine Corps, I entered college as a science major for science education, specifically for science education. And I got a degree in science, a Bachelor of Science degree in all the sciences, specializing in physics. I'm certified to teach all of the sciences in the high schools of New Jersey. That's what my diploma says. And I did teach high school physics, which was my specialty subject, as I mentioned. I taught high school physics, six classes of high school seniors per day. And it got to be I loved the subject, but the monotony was getting to me after a while because there was little room for creativity and little room for thought, because once you know something and you routinely teach it the same material over and over, a person begins to lose their enthusiasm.
Right.
Excuse me. So I decided to go back into my first love, the field of my first love, which was electronics. And I returned to electronics, working at numerous electronics companies during the 1970s and 80s and 90s, actually, for 30 years during the last half of the 20th century. Last part of the 20th century, developed quite a bit of experience working at these different electronics companies, and then went on to use that experience plus my college degree in science education to get into Bell Telephone Laboratories here in New Jersey. And I spent 20 years with Bell Laboratories, which changed from Bell Telephone Laboratories to AT&T Bell Laboratories, and then to Lucent Technologies. I retired from Lucent Technologies and after 20 years, and then went to work for another electronics company for several years, and then retired. Took my full retirement. So close to my retirement years, around 2002, I started getting very interested in this subject of Planet X, because I had been studying Bible prophecy, and I saw a parallel between Bible prophecy and the disasters that the scientists had told us about this incoming Planet X. And I felt a spiritual connection and a spiritual motivation to begin alerting people to this threat, biblical threat, actually. And many people, the good thing about the subject, the easy thing about it is that it's very suitable, and it's a subject that non-believers can be receptive to, because they can deal with the scientific aspect of it alone and understand the threat coming from this brown dwarf star, what scientists believe is a brown dwarf star. So that's what makes it easy, is the great diversity of fields of information which all converge on the likelihood. In fact, that's more than the likelihood. It's a certainty that this brown dwarf star is incoming. Now, many people might say, well, that would be quite a coincidence for some, quite a, a stretch of the imagination to believe that this object would be coming in toward us when you consider that space, deep space, is so large. The air where this brown dwarf star is coming from is so large, why would it come toward us? Well, the answer is gravity. Our sun has a mass which is equal to 300,000 Earth masses. If you were to take 300,000 planet Earths and put them all together, that would be the equivalent mass of the sun. So we all know that by the great scientist Sir Isaac Newton, his principles of gravitation show us that gravitational attraction between two bodies is directly proportional to the mass of body A multiplied by the mass of body B. So you have an incoming brown dwarf star, and brown dwarf stars are, by definition, by astronomical definition, they are, or can range in size anywhere from as small as three Jupiters combined, up to many numerous Jupiters, maybe 100 of them. So we're being very conservative when we say, let us look at it, consider this brown dwarf star to be the smallest possible brown dwarf star that there could exist by definition. And you find out that it's three Jupiters is the smallest mass that this object can have. Well, Jupiter, the astronomers, astrophysicists know that, and this is all published, that Jupiter has a mass equivalent to 318 Earths. 318 Earths combined would be the equivalent mass of the planet Jupiter. Now, Jupiter is probably, it's a very, very good that Jupiter does exist, excuse me, because Jupiter gives us some insight into the nature of this planet X, because Jupiter itself is almost a baby star. It's a large quantity of debris that swirls, space debris, space dust, which, you know, that's about the best that scientists can tell us. It's stellar dust that is in a swirling motion over many years, a great length of time. And as the dust swirls, the particles begin to build up sort of like a snowball. And as they build up, they begin to gravitationally pull in more particles. The larger this snowball of space debris becomes, the greater its gravitational force also becomes. And it pulls in more debris and begins to build up, pulling in comets and asteroids and meteors and all kinds of space objects of varying sizes. And as it builds up its mass, it also, the pressure within this growing ball begins to intensify. And when it intensifies, it becomes very dense, of course. And the density makes this object even more of a gravitational magnet. So it just goes on and on until it builds up enough. Just this is how our sun is believed to have formed, by swirling dust, pulling in on itself, forming a central nucleus, and just increasing in size until the pressure, internal pressure, was so great that nuclear fusion occurred, and that nuclear fusion releases tremendous energy, which we feel on Earth, and that nuclear fusion from the sun is what gives us the heat and the energy to survive here on Earth. Well, that's why I can tell you that it's very likely that this object would be drawn gravitationally into our solar system, because our solar system, like any other solar system that might be discovered, is comparable, analogous to a gravitational well. And a gravitational well could be visualized by analogy as a swirling whirlpool of water going down a drain, for example, or huge vortex of swirling water in a lake. And we've all seen that, so we can really relate to that visually. Water swirling down a drain in a sink. What it does, if you were to drop particles into around that swirling vortex, that funnel of water, those particles would be rapidly drawn into the funnel, sucked into it. Well, that's what happens to any object that comes within the sun's gravitational force field. I can give you evidence that this object indeed has come into our sun's gravitational force field, and that evidence is in numerous major world newspaper reports. The New York Times and the Washington Post for two. Another is the third largest news magazine in the United States, which is U.S. News and World Report. And I have gone to my county library and made photocopies of microfilms, archives of these reports about Planet X, which go back to the early 1980s when the National Security Agency, our secretive spy agency, they spy on us, but they keep everything about their own activities secret, as we know.
Right.
The National Security Agency was not quite aware of the political danger that would be caused in the world's populations if this information about an incoming dwarf star were to be released to the public. So at that time, we had a great opportunity for the scientists, who are generally pretty outspoken and are proud of their work and they're proud of their discoveries. Scientists, astronomers, astrophysicists wanted to publish this information, and they certainly were allowed to until the early 1980s, sometime around the mid-1980s and before, where the National Security Agency forbade these scientists from talking about Planet X ever again. Now, no one was there at their secret meetings. No one is ever allowed to eavesdrop on their secret meetings. So I cannot tell you that this actually happened, but we could see the evidence of it when they were suddenly shut off the information pipeline going to the public regarding this Planet X. But I'll read you the first article, one of the numerous articles that I had photocopied. And it's 1983, January 30th, 1983, from the New York Times, the prestigious New York Times. And the photocopy of it is actually online. You can get it at Marshall Masters' website. Marshall Masters is another Planet X researcher who's done some terrific
work. I've had him on a few times, actually.
Oh, good, good. Yes. So you know his website, and if anyone wants to check out this information and see this actual report, I mean, I can send you the link. But it's all you have to do is remember the name of his website, which is YOWUSA.com. Just Google that term.
Sure, I'll leave it.
And the New York Times, and the term New York Times, and you should come up with that. Planet X report, the actual photocopy of it. Well, I'll start reading it to you now. Now, people are going to say, here, I want to preface my this reading by telling you that this was 35 years ago, January 30th, 1983. And people might say, well, that's old news, you know, so why are you giving us old news? Well, when you look at the solar system, our solar system is incredibly vast. It would take many, many years for an object to travel from the outer bounds of our solar system in toward the inner solar system where planet Earth resides. It would take many, many years. They don't understand the cosmological time frame is huge. And also, this object, when it comes in, by basic physics now, basic physics principles, which I used to teach, when an object is being drawn into another object, normally you would expect it, the gravitational pull of the larger object, to cause that incoming object to collide directly with the larger object due to gravitational attraction. But in this case, you have also a repulsion force, which is the magnetic fields that are generated by these two stars. One is an adult star, that's our sun, pulling on a baby star, which is this planet X. And each one of them, because they are of star character, they have a magnetic field. They spin around. There is our sun. If you study the activity of our sun, you will find its solar activity is highly magnetic. And there are magnetic effects generated constantly. And the sun puts out the generates an interplanetary magnetic field, which sweeps out in waves in three-dimensional space, or in all directions, extending outward from the sun. So the magnetic field of this dwarf star, it will interact with the magnetic field of the sun. And even at greater distances, those two magnetic fields, in this case, have a repelling effect, mutually repelling effect, because the south pole, the north pole of this object, of this incoming object, its north magnetic pole, that is in sort of in closer attraction, pointing in a direction of our sun's south north magnetic pole also. So I should say the south poles of both are in sort of pointing toward one another, and therefore there is a mutual repulsion because like poles repel in electricity and magnetism, or similarly, like charges, like electrical charges repel, like negative and negative would repel, positive to positive charges would also repel. So in with magnetic fields, a positive pole would be repelled by another positive pole. So that's why this object does not directly impact the sun. And it's going to come in and make a loop around the sun. This is what astrophysicists have projected would happen 35 years ago when they were allowed to speak about this subject. And because it makes a loop around, what happens is it doesn't hit directly. It comes in below our solar system's ecliptic plane. And this was stated by a great astronomer, the chief astronomer of the United States Naval Observatory, Dr. Robert S. Harrington, who was doing contract work not only for the Naval Observatory, but also for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. So Dr. Harrington had written reports, Robert Harrington, titled The Search for Planet X. And his studies, he had done intensive computer calculations back in the 1980s, late 70s and early 80s, and throughout the 1980s, trying to estimate the approximate location of this object. And he had pretty much calculated with precision and certainty where this object was, and that his calculation showed that it was coming in below the ecliptic plane, which is that invisible disk in space on which all the planets revolve around the sun. And it's coming in below, doesn't hit the sun, but rides in below it. So if you can visualize this in your mind, make a mental picture of an object coming in below the ecliptic disk and below the sun, when it gets to be even with the sun, the attraction force of the sun is now pulling upward on it. When the object gets right below the sun, the sun is going to gravitationally pull up on it. So now this object is overshooting the sun because of its great momentum. It's already moving at a pretty good speed, and it has a tremendous mass. So therefore, mass times velocity equals momentum, and as you learn in physics. So it continues, even though the sun is pulling up on it, upward, the object is moving upward, but it's also moving by inertia in a straight line direction below the sun. So the net effect of these two, momentum below the sun and overshooting the sun, and the sun's up-pulling force on this object, cause the sun to make a pathway that is, travel a pathway that is circular, elliptical, around the sun, up around the, under from, below the sun to behind the sun, and then up above the sun eventually. So it's like making a U-turn, but the U-turn is not on a horizontal plane, but on a vertical plane. So it comes in below the sun and makes a U-turn up, even with head and shoulders with all the outer planets, and then continuing upward, it goes above the ecliptic plane, and now the sun is pulling back on it. So when it overshoots the sun, what happens? You can visualize this. The sun begins pulling back on the object, and therefore the object will decelerate, but it takes a long time for a large object to decelerate from some high velocity, high speed, is a more correct term, decelerate from a high speed down to a lower speed until it reaches zero. Its speed is zero, but its direction is changing very much, like a going around a U-turn. And then it has to come back again after it reaches its limit. It's sort of like a rubber band, you know, you pull it, keep on pulling back on it, and eventually it reaches its limit. And when it reaches its limit, it starts to spring back in the opposite direction from which it came. And that's what happens. And that's why it takes so many years. People cannot understand, why has this object that people talk about, why has it taken 35 years and it's still not here? Well, first of all, it is here. It's getting closer. We can feel the effects of it. Painfully, we can feel the effects of it, this object. On Earth, the meteorological disasters are just enormous, unprecedented, record-breaking, unprecedented and record-breaking, not only in their intensity, but in their frequency.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about and mention. Now, there you talk about the evidence. When you go online, it's impossible to find accurate evidence about Planet X. There's so much disinformation. Most of it's probably intentional. So the best thing you can do is look for the effects. And the Earth is definitely going through some major changes right now. The seismic activity, the huge earthquake that happened yesterday with the tsunami killed over 400 people. And this is occurring more often. The volcanoes, we have so many erupting right now. Crazy weather. Are these effects, is this the effects that we are feeling from this object?
Oh, yes. And mainly the effects are due directly to the sun's hyperactivity. And that hyperactivity, in turn, is caused by the electrical excitations from Planet X. And how this happens, because, as we all know, astronomers, or mainly astrophysicists, they study this, the effect of physics in space. Astrophysicists all know that the sun is a generator of electrical particles, and the two electrical particles that predominate from the sun are electrons and protons. A proton is simply the nucleus of the very smallest element in the chemical periodic chart. Out of all the elements that chemists know of, the smallest atom, elemental, the atom of the smallest element is hydrogen, the hydrogen atom. It has a nucleus, which has only one atomic mass unit, which is a proton. And it has just one electron orbiting around that nucleus. So when the sun generates its nuclear fusion, where hydrogen atoms are compressed together to form helium. Excuse me. Then what happens is electrons are expelled and protons are also expelled, sort of like the waste product of nuclear fusion. And we see it. I mean, we have known about this for decades, many decades, probably 100 years, about the solar winds. We've all heard about the solar winds, and we get very little information about what they are. But it's mainly it's protons and electrons being blown out by the sun in this nuclear fusion process, which generates the heat that keeps us alive on Earth. So the sun, the Earth is being blasted with solar winds, electrons and protons, and we feel the effects of that very commonly with the aurora borealis in the northern hemisphere and the aurora australis in the southern hemisphere. And those electrons and protons are blown out in all directions in three-dimensional space. So the Earth is not the only target of these solar winds, but all the other planets are also. And the proton that we talked about, the nucleus of the hydrogen atom, is 1,840 times more massive than the electron. So I visualize it and draw the analogy to this disparity in size between electrons and protons. As a baseball player trying to hit a baseball, if you hit a hard ball and with a lot of force, that ball will travel far. But if you take a wiffle ball, a little sponge ball, and hit it with as equal force, the traveling distance is much less. So the electron is like a little wiffle ball. It doesn't go out very far because it doesn't have nearly as much mass as a proton. Consequently, the solar winds, at least in deep space, are because when you get far out, it's like those baseballs that go out into the bleachers. Won't find any wiffle balls in the bleachers, but you find a lot of baseballs out there. So that's what the solar winds create, these proton masses, clouds and clouds of these protons, and they're all electrically charged. I mean, a proton has a positive electrical charge, whereas an electron has a negative electrical charge. But each one has electric charge of equal intensity, even though one is more massive than the other. So now we have a very highly charged cloud of protons surrounding the entire solar system, very far out. I mean, much farther out than Pluto, which is our most distant planet, or was called a planet. The most distant object we know of is Pluto, and this these solar winds carry out far, far beyond that. Now, because you have had such large clouds, massive clouds, surrounding our solar system of positive electrically charged particles called protons, and the general term, incidentally, for all of this entire cloud would be called plasma. We have this electrified plasma, and any object that comes in from deep space, such as this incoming dwarf star, is going to be engulfed and saturated by this plasma, this positive electrically charged cloud of plasma protons. And as a result, when it comes in, it begins to discharge. It acts like a short circuit, sort of, between in within the atmosphere, the vacuum of space in our solar system is a huge vacuum of space, very little or no air, but we have a lot of electrical particles, and it's whenever you have a highly charged object, it comes in and overcomes the insulation. There's an insulation effect because of the distance, so that the electrical discharge of the positive plasma to the primarily negative charge of the sun, the positive to a negative attraction, is resisted. That's why they call it resistance in electronics. The positive to negative attraction is resisted through by the vacuum of space. But when you have an object that is interfering with the all the solar winds that have been built up and saturate the inner solar system, then you have a discharge. It breaks down that resistance, and it's analogous to a bug zapper. We all know that in a bug zapper, you have a high, very intense electric field between two plates within the bug zapper. And when an insect, such as a mosquito or a bee or a fly, gets inside that bug zapper, then the resistance, the electrical resistance, is greatly reduced by that object. And then the high positive to negative attraction is allowed to culminate in the discharge of electricity, electrons and protons. Well, in this case of the bug zapper, it would be electrons that are discharging. Well, that's exactly what happens with this Planet X when it comes in. It breaks down the resistance. It causes a conductive path, and the intensity of these discharges can be very great, because the electrical charges come in sheets. They don't come in a straight line always. They come in sheets. So, and when that occurs, it's like, you know, an avalanche effect of electrons, and the sun feels it. It causes the sun to hyper react to the discharge of all these electrons, protons, I should say, coming back to the sun. So now the sun is becoming hyperactive. And this hyperactivity of the sun has been going on, I would say, going back at least to the turn of the century, about 18 years or more. And that's why you get these tremendous solar excitations, which in turn blast out even more solar winds and solar flares toward in all directions, and many times hitting the sun. And coronal mass ejections, for example, are sometimes pretty much directional, so that if you can pretty much pretty often miss, Earth will not be hit by coronal mass ejections very often, because there's so many other directions in three-dimensional space that the object, that these discharges can occur in, that Earth doesn't usually get hit. But when we do get hit, the effects can be devastating. It happened in the year 1859 with what was famously or infamously known as the Carrington effect, where this tremendous discharge of electricity from the sun hit planet Earth, broke down our Earth's magnetic field, and electrically fried the telegraph lines. At that time, civilization had only developed to the point of having telegraph lines, and many telegraph operators were electrocuted. I don't know how many, but people working on those little electrical momentary switches that key switches that produce the Morse code for the telegraph lines, where that's the information was transmitted by Morse code, dots and dashes of electrical energy. Those people, some of them were electrocuted because of lightning, for example. Lightning is a good example of how people can be electrocuted by touching their telephone. If you have a landline, not a cell phone, but anything electrical, touching a a light switch during electrical storm. If that lightning strikes near you, you can be electrocuted. Or if you're in a bathtub during an electrical storm, you can be electrocuted because of the conductivity of the copper pipes and the water itself. They're both conductive. Well, anyway, I gave you a brief overview, maybe a little bit too wordy, of how this incoming object, because it's saturated with positive electrical charges, will hyper-excite our sun and cause the sun to blast out solar flares that are unprecedented in magnitude. And that's why we're getting all this terrible weather on Earth. Now, the sun's blasting has also caused a long-term effect, of which I think I'm one of the few people who is aware of it. I don't understand. I'm not a PhD in astrophysics, but yet why don't these astrophysicists understand? Or maybe they're not telling us, but they're sort of perplexed because they don't know about Planet X. If they knew about Planet X, they would understand the connection to see why we're getting the Earth's magnetic field is being disrupted so terribly. Why it's shifting, it's getting weaker, it's becoming less focused, and that is terrible because it then degenerates and weakens that shield around our planet Earth. But it's all due to the hyperactivity of the sun blasting out at Earth, breaking down our magnetic field. And when those electrical particles in motion, any electrical particles in motion, which is constitutes the solar wind, they fly out, stream out in waves, like ocean waves, from the sun and hit all the planets, including Earth. They hit the Earth's magnetic field, and the magnetic field is affected by streams of electrons, because streams of electrons in motion, or any electrical charge in motion, generates an electromagnetic field that surrounds the linear path of those moving charges. So it's sort of like a good analogy would be if you were to take a drill bit and take a drill bit and wet it, you know, and then turn drill bit on. As the drill bit spins, it would throw out water in all directions. Or a dog, for instance, if a dog were to jump into a swimming pool and then jump out of the swimming pool and shake itself off as it's running away, that dog would be throwing out water in all directions as it's running away in a straight line path. That's what happens with these streams of electrons from the sun and from the solar wind impacting Earth. Generates electromagnetic fields, which are sort of like jousting poles that joust and conflict with Earth's magnetic field, and they feed back. Electromagnetic energy is, in fact, by basic principles of physics, electromagnetic energy is fed back into the Earth's core from the Earth's magnetic field, because the Earth's magnetic field is sort of like the skin on an apple. If you could, the shape of it, at least, is like the skin on an apple. The skin radiates from the core of the apple, inward, outward, and around, surrounding the apple in all directions, vertically. And that's what happens to the Earth's magnetic field. The solar excitations, electromagnetic excitations from the solar winds feedback into our Earth's magnetic field, and in turn back into the core of the Earth, thus destabilizing the Earth's solid metal core, which rides like a cork. Earth's solid metal, mostly iron, inner core is like a cork floating on the center of a bowl of water, which is rotating on a potter's wheel, if you can visualize that. Visualize a bowl of water rotating on a potter's wheel, and then you put a cork in the center of that bowl of water. The cork would be analogous to the Earth's solid metal core, and the water would be analogous to the Earth's molten metal core. So now the Earth's solid metal core is dislodged from its central point and begins to wobble around, causing an irregularly shaped magnetic field and a weakened magnetic field because it's now staggering, reeling, as the Bible says, as the book of Isaiah chapter 20 tells us, the earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard and shall topple like a top, more or less. A spinning top will topple as it begins to slow down. It loses its stability. It loses its uniform circular motion, rotational motion. That's what's happening to planet Earth in a large scale, in a very slow way.
So what can we expect in the coming months and years? What kind of changes are we looking at? And how bad do you think this will get?
Well, it has to be honest, and I'm trying not to be an alarmist, but when you look at the basic physics, and even at a very basic level as a high school physics student, if you could see that as this object gets closer, the excitations between this object and our sun will intensify, and we've already seen the effects of the interaction between this incoming object and our sun. Over the last 15 to 20 years, we've seen the effects. Worsening storms, more tornadoes, more intense tornadoes. The frequency and intensity of earthquakes is increasing, has been increasing over the past 18 years, even though our secretive government does not want us to know about it, of course, because they do not want to panic the population and thus cause a disruption in the economy and the loss of their monolithic control over the populations. We have greedy, all governments are greedy and seek power and control over the people. That's how they get their wealth and power, by manipulating the public, keeping them in fear and keeping them in deceit. So by giving the people the truth about this incoming object, people would naturally lose their primary fear of the government, because the fear of this incoming object would be far more frightening, far more devastating. So they would prepare, the populations of the world would prepare for disasters, and worst of all for the government, those people would stop, many of them would stop paying their taxes. When it gets to an extreme point where the government is clearly losing control, people will probably stop paying their taxes. And that's why they've been trying to keep it secret, but it's their secrecy is beginning to wither and fade away, as you know, because everyone knows that we have a disastrous phenomenon ongoing, intensifying on planet Earth. The deceitful power elite who control the newspapers, control the government, control the means of communication to the people, their lie about global warming and has been shattered, actually, a number of years ago. They could no longer maintain the lie of global warming, so they changed it to climate change, because there was very opposite reactions occurring. Not only was there warming, but there was intense cold spells, intense snowstorms, a very unprecedented record low temperatures. So everything is getting worse. Pretty soon they won't be able to continue blaming mankind for generating too much, causing the whole problem with Earth by man's supposed creation of greenhouse gases. That lie will no longer hold up soon, as we begin to see the devastating effects of earthquakes. So everything's going to intensify, and information that I can give you, beneficial information, would be to please everyone prepare. Even if you're doubtful, or you should not be doubtful, this information is so overwhelming and it comes from so many different fields of study that people should not be doubtful. But suppose people are doubtful because the human mind, the human character, wants to believe good things and does not want to believe bad things. We know that's the way of human nature. But even if the person is doubtful, get prepared anyway, because it's better, as we all know, the common saying is be prepared and you won't be scared. Or, if you're prepared for the worst and expect the best, but prepare for the worst. And that means what the people in the Carolinas, what has impacted them recently? Horrendous flooding. Many of them were not prepared because they didn't have the benefit of learning about Planet X. Everybody crosses their finger. People who are unenlightened about the intensifying effects of and intensifying disasters of Planet X. People who are unenlightened cross their fingers and hope that, well, it'll get better. Maybe it'll just get better. So I'll just sit back and wait for it to get better, wait for all the storms to subside, all the flooding to subside. And in so doing, in their ignorance and their wishful thinking for a good future, they will set themselves up, make themselves vulnerable for destruction and even death. The loss of their homes, which is happening to so many people, their homes are gone. I mean, people might say and, angrily reply to my warning by saying, look, there's nothing I can do about it. And it's true, it's a difficult situation, but there are things we can do to prepare. I just feel so sad for the people who live in homes that are in flood areas. And even the non-flood areas are now becoming flood areas. I mean, you hear it all the time in the news. This is a 100-year flood, and we had it twice in two years. 200-year floods. And 100-year flood simply means, well, this flood is so bad that we could statistically approximate that this flood would only occur once in 100 years. But yet now it's occurring once every 2 years. So you get hit with the 200-year floods and you've got to move out. You have no choice. People, it's so sad. I feel like crying when I think about all the families and children who are suffering, and it's really not their fault. They couldn't do very much to prevent it. What could they do? Sell their house to somebody else, and that somebody else would then become the victim.
Right.
So I don't know what to say except whenever you can, be prepared. How many people, for example, have died and drowned or almost drowned in cars, in water, in flood areas? Well, they get enough warning from the Weather Channel and from the TV networks, turn around and don't drown. So I don't have to warn them about going into water with cars.
Yeah, I mean,
you
can look at any of the news reports I do almost every day, and I have never seen flooding like that's going on now. Streets are literally turning into raging rivers that are washing away vehicles, destroying homes. The powerful downbursts that are occurring, I've never seen anything like it before.
Right. It is an epic level. This is beyond unprecedented, beyond everything that modern man has experienced in modern history. And you could see it's clear too. It's quite clear, not only in the pain that the victims suffer, but also in the statistics, because they have very good meteorological and geological records that have been kept for well over a century, going back to the late 1800s, say a good 100 and almost 150 years of records.
Right.
Excuse me. And we can see by those records plainly that the situation has gotten worse. More earthquakes. The government has tried to cover up the earthquakes. They're lying. It's been so exasperating and so infuriating to think about the lying of our government. Well, because again, the National Security Agency controls the U.S. Geological Survey, and they tell them, to downplay the intensity of these earthquakes. And they're always doing it. They're always downgrading the intensity of the earthquakes. But the more they lie, the more starkly and glaringly we see the evidence for this object, because it's the cover-up. When a person covers up a crime, then you can see the crime more clearly by the diverse and concerted government cover-ups. Earthquakes. What did they do with the Richter scale, for example? Years ago, they knew this object was coming in, so they took the famous Richter scale and they changed it to other earthquake scales, which are not as accurate and which do not show the true intensity of the earthquakes. I'm trying to think. It's been so long since I've dealt with scale of earthquake scales. I'm trying to think of that earthquake intensity scale, modified. Anyway, I can't think of it right now, but I used to know all this stuff, but you know, it's been, after not dealing with it for a while, you tend to lose some of the specific facts.
Yeah, of course. Name,
Mercalli, Mercalli. You probably heard about that.
Yes.
It uses modified Mercalli scale, which is really a joke, because it deals with what people have observed in their communities. You know, and when an earthquake occurs, it can occur anywhere. It can occur in uninhabited areas. So they're using a modified Mercalli scale to measure earthquakes that don't even, that many of which occur in uninhabited areas. So it is a joke, and it's a farce, and it's an offense to any science-minded truth seeker. And all scientists should be offended, but I don't know what's happened to the nature of scientists lately. They've lost their sense of honesty and careful thinking, such that they believe whatever the government tells them. It's a shame. Yeah. The whole population of the world has been dumbed down and lost their individual ability to think.
Oh, I totally agree. And that's a whole different show there on its own. Now, I wanted to ask you, are we going to be able to see this object?
Oh, definitely. Now, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, a brown dwarf star, and this is, again, what I'm telling you is things that we can all look up, and we should look this information up without taking my word alone. Use all your own investigative skills. You've got the largest library in the world. It's called the Internet, and you can look up the various facts that I'm telling you about. But all scientists and astronomers and astrophysicists know that brown dwarf stars do not emit visible light. They emit infrared light. And in fact, the article I'm going to read to you talks about the infrared astronomical satellite that our secretive government sent up 35 years ago into Earth orbit, near Earth orbit, to find, discover this object. It was an infrared telescope that they needed to discover the object. And yet they lied to us years later, the very same organization, national government, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, lied to us and said that one of their hack spokesmen, I'm trying to remember his name, but he's on the internet, he's on YouTube. He came out and said, if there was a Planet X, and they were forced to come to mention the name Planet X, they always try to shy away from even mentioning anything about Planet X. But he had to come out because so many people were talking about it. So he tried to quell the inquisitive strength of the popular movement of researchers by saying, well, if there was a Planet X, we would have seen it by now. Yet that was a blatant lie, because he knew, being a NASA scientist, knew that NASA itself, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, had launched an infrared astronomical satellite in 1983 for the express purpose of discovering this object, because you cannot see it. It only emits infrared light. Therefore, you need infrared telescopes to see it. Now, when it gets closer, what's going to happen? Its light emission will change, because now you've got a greater electrical attraction. The closer proximity between this electrically saturated brown dwarf star and the attraction, its attraction to our primarily negatively saturated sun. The positive to negative attraction will begin to intensify, and you'll get a higher, different wavelengths of light in addition to infrared being emitted by this incoming brown dwarf star. You'll have visible light being emitted, and you'll have X-ray light, which is all, these are all wavelengths in this, which are of the same character. They're defined as electromagnetic energy, just different frequencies. And a frequency, of course, is frequency is the definition of the number of cycles per second that an object oscillates, or that a particle will oscillate. So, or that electric current will alternate. That's all, they all are scaled in terms of frequency, number of cycles per second. So red light has a very low, has lower frequency, which means it has longer wavelength. Infrared is even longer, and it cannot be seen. We can only see as low as red, and in lower frequency as red. Well, anyway, you won't be able to see it, but as it gets closer, you will be able to see it. It'll begin to light up, probably red, because think about it this way. It's infrared now. So the very first, as it begins to rise up into the, its glow begins to rise up into the visible spectrum, the first colors you're going to see are red, probably. And that's why it's been, I believe in history, it has been, I'm not sure, but I think it's going to be glowing red. So look for that red dot in the sky. But the first thing you're going to see is its outlying entourage of bodies which it has gravitationally attracted in deep space, a huge field of objects surrounding it gravitationally, sort of like iron filings being attracted by a huge incoming magnet. Or sort of like a swarm of gnats swarming around an incoming bird, for example. I'm trying to draw an analogy where people can vividly visualize what I'm describing. Suppose you had a person. So a person's walking through a hot summer night outside, and these gnats are swarming around his head as he's walking. Well, that's the kind of field of objects that you can, in a similar fashion, revolves gravitationally around this object. So we're going to see its outerlying comets first. We're going to see its outerlying asteroids first. We're going to be, the sun will be sucking them in gravitationally. And the sun has been sucking in comets for the last 15 years. In fact, the deceivers in our government have felt compelled to shut off the SOHO Solar Observatory in space. The SOHO Solar Observatory in space has been shut down whenever huge comets came in, and they never give an excuse why. But you can't get any information. They cut the communications, the data line, to the public. And incidentally, what happened recently, they shut down an observatory, a solar observatory, because they don't want to see what's, they don't want us, and mainly they don't want scientists seeing what's happening. Now, this was a very mysterious and scary event that the FBI had no right to do. They went into this, what's known as the Sunspot Observatory,
yes,
in New Mexico, and shut the place down. And what else did they do? They arrested people. They confiscated records, as far as according to the reports that I read.
Now, isn't the cover story that it was some kind of child pornography on a computer that the FBI had to come in on Black Hawk helicopters and shut the whole town and evacuate everybody just for that? Yeah, that doesn't seem
That seems like such a stupid lie. Whoever invented that lie has got to be pretty dumb. So it tells you, gives you an idea as to the low intelligence level of many of our government agencies.
Right.
There's more brute than brains in our government agencies. And crazy. Who could believe that? Anybody, even a child, would question such a stupid excuse. We know it's totally fabricated. It's a lie. It's clearly a lie.
Yeah.
On its face, because of its flimsiness, of child pornography. How could you relate that to an observatory?
Exactly.
So we know, therefore, this is a serious problem. That observatory must have detected comets crashing into the sun. And what do we have now? The threat of a comet. Did you read about this?
Oh, I haven't.
A comet.
No.
Oh, yeah. Check. You could look it up while we're talking here. Just Google, try to get the latest date, just zero in on the most recent reports. Just type in comet, the word comet, and say within the last week. You can go to Google and do an advanced search on time frame, right? You know how to do
that. Oh, the one resembling the human skull? Is that the one you're talking about?
Oh, I don't know much. I didn't get the details on it, but I know there's a threat of a comet.
Okay.
I heard recently, even on the local news, the local mainstream My New Jersey news, they talked about this comet coming in.
Right.
But anyway, there are more of them. I mean, there are you take a swarm of gnats. If you could, you got one gnat coming into your face, you're going to get a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
So there are so many objects that are gravitationally attracted and revolving around this huge dwarf star that, I mean, the impacts are going to be tremendous. Meteor showers have been increasing. Meteor strikes have been increasing. And Chris, somehow if you can, I don't know, pull together listeners who are very astute and interested and like your people are, the people in your groups are, Facebook and other social media. There are many people who are, more than generally interested, so fascinated by this subject that they go out and do their own research and become independent reporters. They're compelled by their fascination to become independent reporters. Get these people, please, to try to do some of the things that I'm suggesting. One of them is that you can go to American Meteorological Society, AMS.org, I believe it is, and you can they collect meteor reports from people, and that is one information channel that is difficult to suppress. The government's good at suppressing information channels. But when you get people calling into the AMS or AMS collecting reports from newspapers of sightings, meteorites, as a meteor crashes to the earth, the meteor becomes a meteorite when it strikes the earth. So in many cases, the meteor does not strike because the frictional heat of the plunging object with the air, the friction caused, generated is so intense that the object begins to light up and burn up in the atmosphere before it even hits the ground, which is a good thing, of course. So these are viewed as shooting stars. When we see a shooting star, that's what you're seeing, a burning meteor catching fire. And many of these sightings have occurred. So now the American Meteor Society becomes a great source of current news as to the intensification of the devastating effects of this incoming brown dwarf star. Just the American Meteor Society alone, you can draw graphs, create graphs that show you the increase in frequency of these meteor sightings. That will tell you a lot. A graph is very, very graphic.
Yeah.
Unintended. So when people see graphs, they say, wow, look at the upswing in meteor sightings that has occurred ever since, say, 2004. And now Or is another way to detect meters? This is what I came up with, and this is what I'd like you to spread to others. Because if you get enough interested people, like your the Facebook groups that we're on, there's a lot of Nibiru, Planet X Facebook groups. People post quite a bit on there. If we can get the word out to these people to do this simple practice, and that is to you go to Google or whatever search engine. I guess Google's good enough. And you type in these two terms, 2018, just the word, you know, the word 20, the number 2018, and space meteors or meteor, singular. And then when you do that, when it does that search, it'll tell you at the top of the page the approximate number of hits of that particular term. Well, the reports would be a media report, for example, would have the date attached to it, right? If it's a newspaper report, online, an online report, it'll have the date. So when you do the search, you'll find that date, 2018, and the word meteor. Meteor was cited, for example, in Australia. I'm just making this up. You know, on June of 2018, that will be one of the hits, one of the millions of hits that are recorded by Google. Then you write down the number of hits, and then go to type in 2017 space meteor, and 2016 meteor, 2015 meteor, 2014, and go all the way down until you get to the year, say the year 2000 or 2001, and you plot those numbers. You should see numbers decreasing as you go down from back in time from 2018. That'll tell you. I mean, I've seen tremendous upswings just by doing that very quickly and in a cursory way without even plotting a graph. And definitely. Now you do the same, pardon me?
No, I was saying definitely good information to know.
That's a way to do it. But we need a lot of people doing this, because one person, nobody wants to hear. If one person says, hey, I found something great, I found some very important information, nobody's going to listen to you, because on the internet, you've got millions of people talking, and you got the voice of the mass media so much overwhelming and just stifling, drowns out the voice of one person, even if that one person might have fabulous, vital information. That person becomes drowned out in the crowd, like one person yelling in a stadium full of cheering fans. You'll never hear that one person's voice. But if you get a bunch of a large group of Planet X researchers all doing the same kind of research with this kind of plan that I told you about, where we could detect easily in the plain, well-known mainstream Google media the number of meteors and plot the number of meteors over the last 18 years. They could be reporting this and drawing graphs and amplifying on it and embellishing it with additional information, so that these reports could be very convincing even to those who would like to forget about it and just get on with their fun. You know, people in social media groups can no longer ignore it when they're interested in other non-essential subjects. They're going to have to be drawn to it because of the fear.
I agree.
Disasters.
There's many, many more people waking up to this. I mean, you see many more people joining these groups, a lot more people talking about it. It is more out in the open, although there is a lot of disinformation that you have to weed through.
From the government, and there's more proof. The government is the one putting out the disinformation.
Oh, yeah, I agree, definitely. We have a couple of minutes left. I'd like you to take that time to, if you have any advice for people, to get prepared. Any advice that you'd like to give?
Let's look at all the different things that could happen. Flooding. What do you do? Look what they're doing. Look at the reports on TV in North Carolina, for example, and other flooding that's occurred in other places. What they've got rafts. People have these rafts that you could survive on them. Some people's houses. I remember the famous story of a woman who was trapped in her home with a big flood, and the gas line was broken because of that, and it caused a fire. Her house was burning down in the midst of a flood. It was flooded, and she was ready to die. and a neighbor came by on a jet ski. That neighbor saved her life with the jet ski. They just pushed that thing to its limit and got out of there just as they got out of the range of the explosion when the house exploded. Wow. So what can you do? You need to get a jet ski, get a raft, get these suits. You know these wetsuits they wear what are the people who go deep sea diving?
Yeah.
Or even off the shore. Get a wetsuit, something, or I bet you can find utilities now, clothing, that is manufactured for this kind of weather where you can go into deep water and stay dry. Oh, all kinds of things. Just use your imagination and look at the problems of flooding. At least you can get some many items that could save your life. For example, a life jacket. If you're in a car and you get flooded out, there's no way you can avoid it. You can open the windows. Get those windows open before your battery gets flooded, or before your electrical system is disabled. Get those windows open. In the old days, they used to have crank open windows. You didn't have to worry about losing electricity. But here you got to open the windows immediately and then try to get out. Otherwise you're trapped. It's a death trap. If you had a life jacket, a life vest, inflatable, compact, maybe you can probably find them. Get a few of them for you and the family. So that you could grab a life vest, even if you don't even have time to put it on, you could get your arms into it and get some flotation. But you got to escape from that car. Or if you're in a home, you need flotation. So you got a life raft. Life vest. I meant to say life vest for the car and for the home and other items like that too. Food, of course. If you can escape the flooding, you're going to need food. Food is going to be the most commonly needed item because many people will not be hit directly by the storms and by the earthquakes. Many people will just say, okay, we're in an area where everything has been, all facilities have been disabled. Electricity has been disabled. Gas lines have been disabled. Water, there's no running water. So now you know automatically what to do. Start storing water in plastic bottles as I've been doing. Recently, somebody told me that, well, you should dump the water out after a while. Well, I guess it gets bacteria, you know, but I've got so much water. I don't know if I could, I guess I have to take my time gradually and just dump it out and rinse out the bottles and put in fresh water. I could do it if I do some every day, if I make a systematic daily effort of it. I can dump out all those bottles of water that I've had stored for about 10 years or more. And replenish them. But if suppose you have to use old water, well, you have iodine. I have the nascent iodine, which is very important for your health anyway, and you put that into the water. So not only do you have good ingredients for your mineral iodine replenishment for your water, but in your water filter that will when you take that dirt, that old water from the bottles, it's tap water, so it's not really dirty, but you have to filter it through a gravity ceramic filter. And so I would put iodine, even though the ceramic filter is impregnated with silver, which kills bacteria, I would still put some iodine in there too. So if I'm using old water, the ceramic filter is going to filter out a lot of the, well, there might be single-celled organisms. I doubt it. I think the only organisms you're going to have are bacteria. So the bacteria is easily killed with the silver and with the iodine. So I may not even have to dump out all that water. I'm going to do a check on it and try to avoid all that effort. But those who don't have water, they don't have to worry about old water because they don't have any water. You better start just saving those bottles. Try to get all the same size bottles so that you can stack them up. Now, stacking, you don't want to go out and you can buy a bunch of shelves that you can assemble. Buy them at Home Depot or Lowe's and assemble them in your basement because you want to stack up as high as you can in order to maximize your storage capacity. But what I do is I get particle board, which they used to call Masonite. Particle board is like a flimsy brown particles. So, you know, it's not as tough as wood, not as rigid as wood, but
right.
It's more rigid than cardboard. You know, everybody, I think you can just go to look it up, particle board, is I think what they call it. They no longer call it Masonite, which is, was a trade name. Anyway, I take cut pieces of that all the same size, and I make shelves out of those. So I stack up a bunch of bottles on the floor of my basement, my concrete basement floor, put them in a big rectangular pattern, and then put one piece of that cut rectangular piece of particle board on top of the bottles, which are all the same height. And then I store more, stack more bottles on top of that particle board. All those bottles are on the same height. You might have ketchup bottles on one layer, and then soda, you know, juice bottles on the next layer. And you could build up 4, 5, 6 layers. You don't want to go too high, but you can build up multiple layers if the bottles are all the same height. They will, you know, support one another. That's what I do in my basement. That's what I recommend people do, because you can get a lot more stored with a lot, and a lot easier in a lot smaller space with particle boards than you can with shelving. But if you want to get shelving, that's fine too. Secondly, food. Oh boy, I got canned food. I got canned chicken meat. Expiration date. Well, it's not really an expiration date, but it says 2013 on it. But it says best by 2013. But you know what? I've got cans of salmon that I bought before Fukushima, before the Fukushima disaster contaminated the oceans with radioactive waste. And I've got so many cans of sardines. I think I've pretty much finished up the sardines. All of them had dates of 2015. Well, 2013, 2014. And I finished the 2015 ones here in 2018, and they tasted okay. The salmon tastes okay. I just been opening the salmon cans that are dated 2015.
Right.
And they taste fine. I keep them in the basement where it's as cool as possible without having to put them in a refrigerator. You can't store very much in a refrigerator. But so if 3 years cans of fish, 3, 4 years old dates on them, that's probably be okay. And if you put some iodine in them, if you suspect that they may be gaining some bacteria, put some iodine or some silver germicide. You do need silver germicide. Very important. A lot of people make their own, but you want to get the particles very small silver particles. That's why you have to find the right brands. There are a number of companies that make silver. Very small particles are much more effective in killing bacteria than the larger particles, the larger colloidal silver particles. That's why I don't really like to go with colloidal silver, rather use ionic silver. Anyway, I'm getting too specific, but the idea is that food and water are going to be the most important thing for the most people, because the majority of the population will not be killed, will not be injured, but they will be starving and they will be dying of thirst when all facilities are dislocated, disabled. Water, electricity, heating. Heating, that's another thing. Get a generator. As long as the gas lines are okay, and the gas lines hopefully will hold up, but you know they're going to break too from the earthquakes. Yeah, but until then, you have an electric generator, gas operated, natural gas or propane gas. Fortunately, I have natural gas feeding my home generator. And try not to get a big one. People make the mistake of trying to electrify their whole house. I just got enough, 1,100 watts, a Yamaha inverter generator. I hang it under my deck, and that's enough to keep to power the basic facilities,
right?
Like the heating and all that. So get prepared. And the main preparation is with God, because this object has been prophesied by God's prophets. I mean, you'd be amazed when you find out what I was spiritually compelled to find in Isaiah, the book of Isaiah of the Old Testament, chapter 63. I wrote a whole paper on it. I think I should send it to you.
Yeah, definitely. I'm also going to have you back on so we can discuss some of the ancient accounts and things like that.
I've got so much information about that. I've got books and paper, so many books all around me where I could never begin to even deal with a tiny portion of it in this short period of time.
There is so much information. And you have given us a lot of great information to go on tonight. I'm going to have you back on to do a follow-up because we are out of time for tonight. But that was some amazing information. John, I want to thank you again for coming on with us tonight. And we'll definitely have you back on. I'll send you another invite soon. And you have yourself a great night, John.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate your helping me to communicate with others who need the help.
Definitely.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Well, you have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.